All right. We'll call this hearing of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is February 21st, 2023. A quorum is present. The first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes from February 16th, 2023. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Johnson moves the minutes. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Let's see. First up today, House File 146, Representative Finke. And just to remind members, we previously took public testimony, did some amendments on this bill, but it's the first time this bill has been heard in the legislature, and we had a lot of public testimony, and so now we've got some more time to bring it back for member discussion. So we'll just remind folks in your packets, we did already approve the A1 amendment, so that's the language that we're working off of. It was just correcting some internal cross-references to the correct statute. So the bill, I will, Representative Finke, would you like to move House File 146 as amended back in front of us?
Yes, I would like to move 146 back to the committee.
All right. And the motion is that it be placed on the general register. I will let you recenter us on the bill and just remind the public and the members what this bill is, and then we'll move on to member discussion.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and members. House File 146 is a bill to protect trans kids, gender expansive kids, and their families who do not live in Minnesota, who are looking to access legal health care in the state of Minnesota. That's all it does.
All right. Moving on to member discussion. Representative Curran.
Yes, Chair, I'd like to call for a roll call on this.
All right. Roll call requested. The clerk will take note of that. Further discussion. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question about how the temporary custody provision works. I've gotten some emails talking about kidnapping, and so I just wanted to make sure I understood how those provisions of this bill would work. Thank you.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Feist. I appreciate the question. I get this question often as well around what the custody provisions are doing, and simply put, the custody provisions of the bill are allowing temporary jurisdiction in the state of Minnesota for court cases and custody cases to be heard. It doesn't change anything about how a custody case would be heard in the state of Minnesota. Custody hearings are about the best interest of the child. That does not change when we have a custody hearing in Minnesota, but temporary custody in Minnesota allows gender-affirming care to be considered one potential option for being in the best interest of the child. Presumably, these are cases that are coming from states that have banned gender-affirming care and thus make gender-affirming care always in the worst interest of the child. And this bill, and in the state of Minnesota, that is not true. It does not force any parent who is in Minnesota to give their child gender-affirming care, but it does allow court jurisdiction for the time, temporary. Emergency jurisdiction is by definition temporary, to consider what the best interest of the child is. And in the state of Minnesota, that includes gender-affirming care when necessary.
Any follow-up, Representative Feist?
No, thank you.
All right. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Finke. Can you describe for the committee, because I think there's a lot of rhetoric around it, but what gender-affirming care looks like in the state of Minnesota?
Representative Finke.
Thank you for that question, and Chair and Representative Frederick. And I will turn that over to my testifier.
All right, and please reintroduce yourself for the record. We did ask Dr. Gepfer to come back since they were part of the initial presentation of the bill. Dr. Gepfer, if you could reintroduce yourself for the record and go ahead and answer the question, please.
Thanks, Chair Becker-Finn. My name is Dr. Angela Cade Gepfer. I am a pediatrician at Children's Minnesota and the medical director of our gender health program. And thank you for that question, Representative Frederick. Gender-affirming care at its heart is really about the process of supporting transgender and gender expansive children to whatever outcome they end up pursuing. So it's really about working with kids and families to make sure that they are loved and supported, that they have the resources they need in schools, they have the resources they need in their communities, they can get their questions answered about the process of gender exploration that their child is going through. That is at the heart of what we do. The vast majority of kids who come to our program do not receive any medical treatment at all. Some of the children who come to our program when they are adolescents may receive reversible treatments such as puberty suppression or menstrual suppression, and some of our older adolescents may be eligible for gender-affirming care in the form of masculinizing or feminizing hormones that are partially reversible. All of our care is undertaken with both mental health and physical health in mind, so we have an integrated approach that involves the family, mental health practitioners, medical practitioners. All of our care is guided by national and international standards, including the Pediatric Endocrine Society and the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. And all of our care has been well studied and has been around for decades. So thank you for the question.
Any follow-up, Representative Frederick?
Thank you, Chair. I think the only follow-up question I have is that some of the rhetoric that's out there doesn't align with what you just described. And so I'm curious in what your thoughts are of the impact of some of that false rhetoric has on the care that you're describing.
Dr. Gepford.
Yeah, thank you. The rhetoric is really designed to scare people. I think that we fear that which we don't understand. And a lot of people in the community who don't have transgender children, don't know transgender people, don't really understand what gender-affirming care is. What we have seen in our program is that a lot of parents are very nervous to come in to see us because they are afraid of some of what they've read online. They feel very reassured once they come in and understand that we're there to partner with them and understand what their family and what their child needs, and it's going to be different and unique for each family that comes in to see us.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frederick, actually, for those questions, because that actually leads into what I was curious about asking about, in particular the statutory definition of gender-affirming care in gender-affirming health care page 5, line 16. In the debate yesterday and in the previous testimony about the bill and just now, I've heard gender-affirming care described as it needing to be medically necessary, developmentally appropriate, and individualistic or unique to each particular patient. And so I just wanted to ask a couple of questions about the way that this definition works and is going to work in the court cases that we have about this. So it uses the word the words medically necessary on page 5.16, and then it lists four different subparts, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and number 4 says developmentally appropriate exploration and integration. Parts 1, 2, and 3 just say interventions and don't say developmentally appropriate interventions, and so I was curious as to why, if there was a reason that language wasn't used in subparts 1, 2, and 3.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and Representative Niska for that. I'll be honest, I don't have a great answer for that question right now. I don't want to spin the ball while I'm at the testifiers table here, but I don't think it would be particularly problematic for us to have developmentally appropriate. All of this care is developmentally appropriate. So that's something that I think we can look at.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke. That's kind of what I was hoping the answer was. I looked at it and I couldn't think of a reason why that was left out. But I'm curious as to how this is going to work in practice, because a lot of the different provisions in this bill drive back into either a child wanting to receive gender-affirming care or not being allowed to receive gender-affirming care. And so there's going to be a lot of Minnesota court proceedings in which a district judge presumably is going to have to decide whether a particular child has not being able to receive gender affirming care or in those situations, do we anticipate that there's a, because it's a unique individualistic question, do we anticipate there's going to need to be factual findings made by a district court judge about whether particular things are medically necessary and developmentally appropriate for that particular child?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and Representative. You know, these cases aren't that unusual. We will have custody cases. They happen all the time. People come from other states to try to try their custody cases all the time. I don't see why this is particularly those decisions will be made on a case-by-case basis, and I don't think that there's a reason to assume that findings in favor of medical necessity are suddenly going to become any different than they are in any other case for any other treatment. But I would also pass it over to Dr. Gepford.
Dr. Gepford.
Yeah, you know, my assumption as a pediatrician and a medical professional who's been practicing in the state for 17 years is that it wouldn't be the judge who would be making those decisions about what is medically necessary and developmentally appropriate, but the medical professional who's caring for the child and the family. And I have frequently been asked whether it's for gender-affirming care or any other care I provide to kids to provide a letter of support or a testimony about why a child needs a particular type of care, whether that be to an insurance company or a custody hearing. So I would assume that the definition of what is medically necessary for a child would continue to be made between the healthcare provider and the family, and then they would petition for that care, would be my assumption.
Follow-up, Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Gepford, for that explanation. I want us to remember, though, we're thinking about situations in which there is apparently some dispute between someone about what is medically necessary and developmentally appropriate, and this is an area where there is a lot of debate about what is medically necessary and developmentally appropriate. I'm thinking of the article that just came out recently from a case manager at a hospital in Washington University, St. Louis, where that's sort of the core of the question. I'm sure there will be expert testimony, perhaps on one side or many sides. Ultimately, I think it will be up to a district court judge, and I think we need to have our eyes open about kind of the job that we're creating for district judges in the state of Minnesota by passing this law. I did have a follow-up question, Madam Chair, about section one of the bill.
All right, Representative Niska.
I am concerned when we start singling out or essentially saying that we disagree and don't want to enforce judgments that are from other states. And so I was curious whether the bill author is aware of or concerned about other states potentially responding in kind to Minnesota, saying that we don't agree with their laws and don't want to abide by their judgments. Are there ways that other states might respond to that in ways that are harmful to Minnesota?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Niska. I am aware of that. In fact, other states are doing that right now by banning the ability of their residents to get care in Minnesota. I don't think that this is something that is new. We've litigated in spaces like this before in terms of whether a state has to recognize someone else's marriage. We have had many times in the history of this country's legal proceedings where one state and another state disagree, and we can resolve that. We will resolve that in due time in the courts, in these bodies. But I think that just as South Dakota has the right not only to ban health care but to ban traveling to receive said health care, we have a right to protect health care and protect people who want to arrive here for health care.
Follow-up, Representative Niska.
Just a comment on that. I think undermining the full faith and credit clause actually goes in the wrong direction, especially given the marriage example. But I did have one other question about the temporary emergency jurisdiction. provision. I just wanted to clarify that the way I read it, no parent is required to be in the state of Minnesota in order for temporary emergency jurisdiction to kick in. And so I was curious about whether this applies in either a situation of a runaway or some other non-parental family member bringing the child to Minnesota, and whether that creates any concern that we need to be worried about of really interference in the relationship between a child and both of their parents.
Representative Finke.
I'm sorry, can you just the question part again?
Yeah.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. A lot of the discussion around this bill has been about making sure that parents' rights are protected, and I'm concerned that the temporary emergency jurisdiction provision, the way it's worded, actually is going to undermine that in certain circumstances, because it doesn't require the presence of any parent in Minnesota. Leads me to be concerned about either a runaway situation, maybe someone is lured to Minnesota by somebody else, or a situation where some other family member, you know, an aunt or uncle or, you know, someone else helps that child to come to Minnesota, and whether that raises concerns that we are going to interfere with some parental right situations.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. I'm not concerned about that. We do have existing laws around how we interact with individuals who are either running away or trafficked, I think is the question that you're asking. This bill does not change the need to comply with out-of-state courts. It does allow temporary emergency jurisdiction for custody cases to be heard, but it doesn't determine who will receive custody in those cases, or a lot overstep its boundaries in terms of custody cases that are proceeding in other states.
Are you?
I'm done.
Okay, great. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke, and your testifier for being here. And just wanted to go back to Section 5 to help perhaps allay some of Representative Niska's concerns regarding medical necessity, and I think that's the key term is medical necessity. There has to be a finding of medical necessity that the care, whatever it is medically necessary. Now, there can be disagreements as to what is medically necessary, and there's debates among providers as to that, as there is with any other types of care, whether it be cancer care or whatever, and what is deemed medically necessary. But it seems like there's a safeguard there that it must be medically necessary to receive this care. Just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Finke.
I want to thank you, Chair and Representative. And I do want to just take a moment to recognize that it's very hard to convince your insurance company that gender-affirming care is medically necessary. I want to dispel, I think there's an idea that people can get access to this care just willy-nilly. Talk to any person who is trans or gender expansive and who has accessed the system of insurance-based gender-affirming care, and you will realize that these decisions are not being made lightly or without extreme due diligence to the medical necessity of them. This is not something that is just being handed out to people because they asked for it. And I think Dr. Gepford would like
to. Dr. Gepford.
Yeah, and just in response to Representative Niska's earlier line of questioning, you know, we still are beholden in the medical field to our responsibilities to consent for care. So I can't provide any care to a child without parental consent, and it is up to me to determine who holds the custody for that child. So not only is it my responsibility and my colleagues to determine whether something is medically necessary, which as Representative Finke pointed out, is a long process that involves both mental health professionals as well as our team of subspecialists, but it also does involve parents, and that's a very important part of our care. And so as Representative Finke pointed out, there's nothing about crossing the state line in Minnesota that magically grants a child access to care. They still would go through all of the process that we currently have around this care, all of the safeguards and all of the consent rules that we have around the care as well.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative. Thank you. I do have some concerns on this bill. One, which Representative Niska brought up on, in section one. And I'm just wondering, I've dealt with these situations where a non-custodial parent has basically kidnapped the child, brought him to another state, including Minnesota, and then gone to court for custody. So I'm wondering if a non-custodial parent or guardian brought a child into the state of Minnesota for this process and did the things, would they have standing in the court to bring this forward?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair and Representative, for the question. I'm not a family lawyer. If a person is kidnapped and brought to the state of Minnesota for accessing health care, I would assume that that standing would be no different than another parent person who kidnapped a child and brought them to Minnesota. We are not legalizing kidnapping. We're not making the courts determine that abducting a child and bringing them to the state of Minnesota is protected behavior. There is no reason that this bill would interact with those situations differently than the courts currently do. And, you know, I also I want to remind folks that to your point, there are very, very difficult situations that arise in our court system around custody. This bill is not disregarding the difficulty of those decisions, nor is it changing the laws to make those decisions favorable towards gender-affirming care. We're interacting with the system that exists in a way that says gender-affirming care should be considered one option in a child's well-being, but we're not looking to interfere with the idea that somehow we can allow kidnapped children into Minnesota to receive care, because we're not evil. We're not monsters, right? The idea that we want to bring kidnapped children to Minnesota to receive gender-affirming care, like, this law doesn't do that. And we don't want to do that. Nobody wants to do that. And I know that that's not what you're implying, but I get this a lot. A lot of people are implying that I think we should be giving gender-affirming care to every child. We can kidnap them. We can abduct them. It doesn't matter. Get them in the state of Minnesota and give them gender-affirming care. And that's just an absurd principle to be directed at me and to the doctors who do this work and to the lawyers who protect children. Like, we're just working in the system that exists in the best way we think we can to protect this care.
And I will also just weigh in. So I worked in family court for many years. I worked, as we had in our previous discussion about court clerks, I was a person who researched the issues, you know, listened to the testimony and drafted orders under the direction of the judge, the judicial officers that I worked for. And I think it's important to remember is that you have to read the rest of that chapter of statute. And we're just adding, what this bill is doing is just adding as a potential reason for the court to even consider temporary custody orders that they've not been able to obtain the care that is defined within this bill. You know, so if you read like more through like lines 3.5 through the rest of page 3, you know, if there's already an order somewhere else, the court in Minnesota can't just ignore that order. They still have to communicate with the other court. I mean, it is very common, you know, especially here in Minnesota, to, you may have one parent who moves to Wisconsin or Iowa or the Dakotas, and there is multi-jurisdiction, you know, there are determinations that have to be made, but typically that's, you know, the court's still following all the rules of the best interest of the child and the other parameters of how they make those decisions. This bill's just adding this as a factor that may allow them to even start to consider that. So hopefully that's helpful. One question I did have that I think might be helpful for folks to understand what we're talking about and the kinds of situations. I'm wondering, Representative Finke, if you can speak to what is happening in other states right now. I know I've been contacted by people from other states who are wondering what we're doing here in Minnesota because they, the states they live in, are not recognizing their needs. And so I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to that, maybe with the, you know, some examples so folks can kind of get their heads around why this bill.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And I mean, that's this. There is a, this bill is here because there's a need we need to meet. The need that we need to meet is that there are young people who are receiving gender-affirming care in states where that that care is being immediately taken from them. They're receiving, as I said last night, they're receiving life-saving care. And their families are put in situations where they're no longer going to be able to access that care, and they're not sure what they're going to do about it. They're being in states where not only are they going to lose their health care, but the right to get that health care somewhere else is being taken from them. They're banning the ability not just to receive care, but to access that care anywhere. And that's a real need. It's such a real need. We have many people, families, I will let Dr. Gepford speak on this too, but who are already here for this reason, who are coming here for this reason, who are messaging me, who are letting me know we better follow through with this because they're already packing. They're already looking for homes. People are scared. They don't know what to do. They need care. They want to understand that their child has a future where they're healthy and able to live their authentic lives. And we also need to recognize that while we are having a conversation around children receiving gender-affirming care, this is not a question about children's gender-affirming care. There are states that have banned care for 18. There are states that have banned care for people who are 21. There are states that have banned care for people up to 25. And Texas has introduced a bill to just ban insurance coverage for gender-affirming care for all people. So we try to have this conversation around the most vulnerable members of the community, but there's no denying that the point of what we are seeing nationally is to take gender-affirming care away from every person in the country. That's the goal. It may not be the goal of the people in this room, but we are already seeing adults who are coming to receive their gender-affirming care because the writing is on the wall, their states are taking it away. So when we say, oh, adults can do what they want, last night I was told that on the floor, we don't care what you do, adults do anything you want, it's simply not true to say that that's what this argument is about. It's about erasing trans people, taking away our right to access care. Minnesota needs to protect it, and people are coming here now because we're putting our flag down to say we will protect it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. Representative Finke is discussing motives.
Okay, so point of order. I don't hear motives directed at any member of this body. I hear a discussion to the larger issues that are happening in our country.
Well,
you can't just start talking and interrupt. If you want to call point of order, you can state your point of order,
right,
and then I'll decide. But that is not what I hear happening.
Okay.
There's no direction to a member. There's no pointing at a direct person. It is speaking to Representative Finke's views of what is happening largely within our country. But I will ask you to be careful with your language choice, because if people are interpreting that way, we can all try to be better to be more clear in our language choices.
Thank you. And to Representative Scott, I do apologize for the idea that I mean, obviously this is an issue that I care deeply about and get passionate about. And I will end on this, but nobody in this committee, but members of your party in this body are doing this. So it isn't false to say that there are no people here in this body who are doing this.
I had a comment.
Oh, everybody stop talking. I can't have multiple people in. You get on the list by communicating with Anna or Ella. I will get to you. All right. Representative Johnson still has the floor. Representative Johnson, do you have any follow-up?
I have actually quite a bit of follow-up and a few more questions. Chair Becker-Finn, we got off on a long story that had nothing.
Representative Johnson, if you could get to your question, we've got other members of on your side of the aisle that would like to have a chance to speak as well. So let's focus.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Finke, I think that in section one, I think it needs to be tightened up to make sure that it's the custodial parent. I've had issues in my career in law enforcement, where it's take once they find the child where the non-custodial parent has taken the child, it can take a long time to get things straightened out. We had a person in our county that he had custody of the daughter. The mother had no custody, took her to another state. It took 6 months, 6.5 months just to find where the daughter was taken. And another year in the courts to get her back to Minnesota to the father who had custody in Minnesota. So those are issues that need to be taken care of. So I think it'd be a good thing to put custodial parent in that section, or custodial parent or guardian, because that clears things up. So it's the person that the courts where they live in another state already have done the stuff to make sure that the right person has custody already. That's just a cleanup. I'm trying to make things better, because if we don't do that, and in on line 3.3, in section 3, it also affects that area. Because we're changing dramatically the temporary emergency custody. Because generally it's been for when somebody comes into the state and they're mistreating or abusing a child, or the child was abandoned. That's the only time that the state of Minnesota gets into custody, and that's granting them to foster care or changing it because the child has been mistreated, severely mistreated, or abused. And now we're adding another section to Jane, obtain gender-affirming care. And with other states, that line there, I think, is going to end unless we get the custodial guardian or parent in section 1. I think it's going to create a lot of problems with what's called the interstate compact we have with kids, dealing with runaways, warrants, and a whole bunch of other issues, how we get these kids back to the parent that actually has custody. And if we have problems with the interstate compact, we have problems in a lot of places. We have to make sure that we fill in so the interstate compacts we have with all the other states, we don't have issues, because that can create a lot of problems. And the final question I have for you, Representative Finke, is if the state takes temporary custody, and let's say it could be a runaway type deal, and goes into foster care or some type that becomes under a ward of the state while working these things through, and they decide to get the gender-affirming care, who is responsible for the payments for that? Is that going to be the state of Minnesota?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for your questions. And I believe that you want to make the bill better. I would love to go back and talk about this custodial parent, the language, what it means, what it doesn't mean, because, again, I'm hearing it makes sense to me, but I'm not a lawyer. So I do presume that there's good faith there. And in terms of who would pay for that gender-affirming care, I'm sure that there is someone in this room who would have a better understanding of what that answer is. Who pays for fostered individuals' health care now would presumably cover that care.
Representative Johnson.
That would be the state of Minnesota. Yeah.
Representative Finke.
I appreciate knowing that, and I'm very comfortable with that.
All right. Representative Grossel. You knew you were on the list.
I didn't know which part of the list. Thank you, Madam Chair. Caught me right in the middle of taking a swallow of water. I guess I have a couple questions, Madam Chair. They'll be short. First one, are there any age limits in the bill? And how old, I guess if there are age limits or there are no age limits, how old should somebody be for hormone therapy?
I'm assuming the...
That's a question.
I'm assuming the pediatrician who has a lot of experience is probably Dr. Gepford.
Yeah, I'm happy to field this one. So there are both national and international standards around this care. So the Pediatric Endocrine Society recommends that adolescents be 15 or 16 years old before considering what I think you're referring to, which would be masculinizing or feminizing hormone care. Mm-hmm. The caveat there is that it has to be developmentally appropriate care. So there, that care has to be individualized for the child. So if a child has a developmental disability, if a child is in a mental health crisis, all of those things have to be considered. So I can't tell you that after a child reaches a certain threshold age, they automatically qualify for that treatment, because their development, their parental consent, how the parents are supporting that care or not, their mental health, all of that has to be taken into account. But I can reassure you that we're not talking about young prepubertal children here.
Representative Grossel.
Madam Chair, Representative Finke, I guess this one would be for you then. Are there any age limits in this bill anyplace?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. There are not age limits, because this is care that is determined to be case by case with families and with doctors.
Follow up, Representative Grossel.
Yes, Madam Chair. Yeah, I guess this would be back to the doctor here.
Sure.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm mistaken. Hearing's not so good these days, and I'm getting older. But I believe you said that some of the treatments are reversible, and others are only partially reversible.
Correct.
Did I hear you correctly?
That is correct,
Dr. Gepford. Yes, that is correct.
And I guess
Russell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, what? And Representative Finke, I guess both of you. What happens to these children who changed their minds on some of these treatments, and some of this stuff is not fully reversible?
Dr. Gepford?
So part of our process in supporting kids is to understand and support their process of gender development. In doing that, what we know is that the rate of regret or changing one's mind about their gender identity is very, very small. In that case, this is care that is provided with consent of parents and with assent of the adolescent. The medical age of decision-making or capacity is generally determined to be 14 or 15 years old. We're talking about kids who are older than that in many cases. And we take this medication treatment very slowly. So changes are happening very slowly over time. A child would be well over the age of 18 before they were experiencing significant changes that could be considered permanent.
Representative Grossel.
Madam Chair, thank you. Can you give some examples of, Doctor, can you give some examples of some of these treatments that are only partially reversible, and what that leads to?
Dr. Gepford.
So what it leads to is the affirmation of someone's physical self with their gender identity.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I want to.
Well, you did. So you just get my attention. I'll call on you again. Representative Grossel.
Hey, Madam Chair. Go ahead, Doctor. I'm sorry.
Sure. Dr. Gepford.
So the outcome of gender-affirming hormone therapy is to align someone's body with their gender identity and alleviate their mental health distress. So that's what it leads to. I think what you're asking is the physical changes particularly. And so the things that we think about with estrogen would be breast growth, and the things that we think about with testosterone would be hair or facial hair growth and voice deepening.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you. So I guess my question was, what are some examples of these things that cannot be reversed? And I guess facial hair for a young lady who changes her mind, or chest hair for a young lady that changes her mind, or breast growth for a young man that changes his mind.
Representative Grossel, I think, be careful, like, your language. I think your language choice is just indicating that you may be not fully understanding that it's not.
I think I'm fully understanding, Madam Chair, that there's some things that are
Representative Grossel, that are not
fully reversible for these
Representative
kids.
Grossel, I'm going to give you the floor. I'm just asking you to be careful with your word choice and some of the assumptions being made. Representative Grossel.
Doctor, am I off?
Yes,
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Don't point at me, Dr. Gepford.
Yes, you are off, Representative Russell. What we are talking about is affirming breast growth in young trans women and affirming hair growth in young trans men. So that's where your language would be off.
So some of these...
Representative Russell.
Thank you. So some of these youth may be left with some partially irreversible things that they would be scarred with for life then.
That is
Dr. Gepford.
Representative Russell, that is incorrect. What we know and what every major medical organization agrees to is that the well-studied effects of gender-affirming care in adolescents is that it improves their mental health and it decreases their suicidality. So what I know to be true in my care of kids is that puberty itself has permanent effects. So what we're really talking about is, do estrogen and testosterone have reversible or permanent effects? And the answer is that when we force transgender children to go through a puberty that does not align with their identity, they experience significant mental health distress, and that is what we are trying to prevent.
Anything further, Representative Russell?
No, Madam Chair, because I'll just get in trouble anyway, so thank you.
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I had a question that was related to something that Representative Johnson asked, but he just stepped out of the room. So I also had a comment, so I'll start with the comment.
All right, Representative Moeller.
Back in. And so I just, you know, there was some questions earlier about Section 5 and some maybe discomfort about courts making some decisions around gender-affirming care and what's medically necessary. And I fortunately don't have my computer here, but I was trying to quick look up on my phone, and the chapter related to parenting custody, you know, even already courts are making decisions about special medical, mental health, developmental disability, and other needs that a child may have. So courts are comfortable making decisions like this. This happens in other areas of law. So I don't think it's unusual that we would ask the court to be considering these factors at all. And then the other thing, I had a question for nonpartisan staff, because I think, you know, Representative Johnson raised in Section 1 the issue of adding custodial parent. And Madam Chair, like you had said, this is part of a bigger section of statute. And so I was wondering, under Chapter 260, just in general, does it talk about custodial parent, or is that the assumption that's already built into this?
Research. Chair and members, this is Mary Davis from the House Research Department. So I think there's a little bit of confusion. Representative Johnson was talking about two different sections. He brought up Section 1, but when he was talking about custodial parents, he was actually talking more about Section 3, the temporary emergency jurisdiction. So Section 1 only deals with situations where an agency, which is the government in another state, is removing a child in a child protection case related to gender-affirming care. So that is, 260 is about child protection. Section 3 is about custody when there is not a child protection case. So in a temporary emergency jurisdiction, as Representative Johnson brought up, that could be anybody who needs to avail themselves of the laws of Minnesota and request temporary emergency jurisdiction. Is that clarified?
Representative Moeller, any follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. Just wanted to say thank you, Representative Finke, for bringing this bill, and I'm happy to vote in favor of it. Thank you.
All right. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Finke, there's a family law attorney, practicing family law attorney in the audience, and that could answer some of the questions that we've had. Would you be interested in hearing from that person?
Representative Scott, we're not going to have additional testifiers called up. We initially had this bill heard on January 31st. If you had questions, there was plenty of time to have those questions answered.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that. This attorney was in a hearing at during the same time over in the Senate. Couldn't be here. So I feel like we have a doctor here that's giving all sorts of answers, but we don't have someone. This is the jurisdiction of family law, and we have someone in the audience that I would like to ask questions of that practices this every day, and just as the doctor practices their profession every day in this field, and we're not being allowed to hear from them. This is, and Madam Chair, quite frankly, this bill, since we learned that the state of Minnesota would be paying for people that come here that can't afford this care, this bill should be going to one of the health committees because of that. It deals a lot with what's medically necessary. The definitions in this bill have to do with health care, gender-affirming health care, and I believe that it should make that stop. And there might even be a fiscal note to this if the state of Minnesota is going to be paying for this care. So I would move that this bill be re-referred to one of the health committees that would have jurisdiction, so health, finance. And I can make that motion at the end here if that's appropriate or whenever, but I do have some additional questions, but I'll wait for your response.
Yeah, well, there was a lot there, Representative Scott. We took more testimony and allowed more public testimony on this bill than any bill. If there's some attorney who chose to be somewhere else and chose to be here, that was their choice. You asked me on the fly as we were up here, and I told you that is not the practice. We're not going to do that. We're not going to have members of this committee on either side randomly choose people and call them up when we're past the point of public testimony. That's just not a thing that we're going to do. We have Ms. Davis here. We have Mr. Johnson here. We've got House research, people who know what they're doing, who know the law, who are here to answer questions if you'd like to ask them any questions. Further to the discussion about whether this needs to go to some other committee, I mean, we heard a potential scenario with a lot of if scenarios where you might end up in a situation where a person may end up as a foster child here and then need care and then it being approved as medically necessary. Like, there are a lot of things that would need to happen. I don't think it rises to the level of needing to send this to anywhere else. The motion that's before us right now is to move this bill as amended to the general register. So just want to make sure procedurally we're all on the same page. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'll go ahead and ask my questions then of the bill's author. But I really would ask that the testifier, that's the physician, not answer any other questions then if we're not allowing public testimony.
We're not going to do that. It was I figured there would be some medical questions, and Dr. Gepford was part of the presentation of the bill, which is different than public testifiers who sign up separately. So that was the distinction. Knowing that House Research knows legal stuff and not medical stuff, I asked Dr. Gepford to be here, and it's been actually, I think, very fruitful and helpful for all of us to have these questions answered that members on both sides have had. So that's how we're going to proceed. Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, Representative Finke, so if I want to address the top of page 5, and it's under the section that deals with an inconvenient forum. And if one parent brings a child here for gender-affirming care, and the other parent lives in Alaska, do you believe that that would be inconvenient for the parent that lives in Alaska?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Scott. Can you point me to a line that we're reading just so I can make sure I know where we are?
Yep, Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, this would be the top of page 5 through, it's 5.1 through 5.5. And preceding that, all of page 4 basically talks about inconvenient forum.
Representative Finke. And actually, I'll ask, I don't know if research knows, do we have a definition of inconvenient? It's kind of a legal ease question. I don't think the word inconvenient doesn't maybe mean inconvenient in the way that any of us lay people may think of it.
Chair and members, Mary Mullen or Mary Davis from the House Research Department. Section 4 of the bill deals with inconvenient forum, and this is part of the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Enforcement Act. So when you're trying to determine which state, if a state is an inconvenient forum, you can kind of look at 4.8. This is the beginning of a factor test that the court has to do. In the hypothetical that Representative Scott has posed about Alaska, the court would be deciding whether domestic violence occurred, the length of the time the child has resided outside this state, that's Minnesota, the distance between the court in this state and the court in a state that could assume or would assume jurisdiction, financial circumstances of the parties, agreements of the parties as to which state should assume jurisdiction, the nature and location of evidence required to resolving litigation, the ability of the court of each state to decide the issue expeditiously, and the procedures necessary, familiarity with the courts in each state. So they would look at a number of factors to make a determination about inconvenient forum. The paragraph that's been added by this bill is that in a state where gender-affirming health care for a child is at issue, a court in the state shall not determine that the state's an inconvenient forum if the law or the policy of the other state that could take jurisdiction limits the ability of a parent to obtain that health care for the parent's child. So that's what's being added. But there is a factor test that the courts would do for those cases.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that explanation. So, Representative Finke, if someone wants to bring their child here from Alaska for gender-affirming care and the other parent, let's say the other parent that maybe opposes that gender-affirming care lives in Alaska, let's say they're low income, which are two factors here. Mm-hmm. So what your bill does is say that those things shouldn't matter if Alaska is a state that doesn't affirm that that same care. So do you think that's a hardship for the other parent?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Scott. According to what was just given to us, would depend upon whether or not Alaska's policies or not allow gender-affirming care to be considered in the best interest of the child, right? So if we're talking about a case here in Minnesota, that I guess the question about, like, is it a hardship on the parent? I mean, I'll leave to, like, the legal individuals who are in the room, but I do want to say that the ability to have that case heard in Minnesota is simply an ability to have a judge who considers gender-affirming care to be one of the considerations in how to treat this child's future, right? We're not saying you must. We're not stealing away anybody's jurisdictional rights, and we're not ceding it to anybody else. We're saying we can consider gender-affirming care to be on the menu of options for this child's well-being. We're not forcing anyone to make a decision. In terms of the question of hardships for custodial cases, I leave that to the experts.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'll ask House Research, in a case like that, does this bill give any judicial discretion as to whether they can or cannot determine the inconvenient forum?
Ms. Davis.
Would they have to rule this law shall override the inconvenient forum piece?
Chair and members, Mary Davis from Hilton. I think the question you're asking is the court can determine inconvenient forum in these child custody jurisdiction cases, either on their own accord or because someone has raised the issue. It's sort of secondary to determining jurisdiction, so you would use the other parts of the UCCJEA to determine jurisdiction, but then the court might say, in the end, we've decided that we are an inconvenient forum and go through this factor test. If they got to that point and they were going to determine, and they thought maybe it was an inconvenient forum, they would look at this paragraph if it were added, and they would say, well, the other state where you would be going has determined that you can't obtain gender-affirming care there, and so we won't decide that this is an inconvenient forum. And I think that's what Representative Finke said as well. So that's what they would decide, yeah.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, you know, I feel like that portion alone could be an assault on parental rights, because there may be a parent that just can't afford to come and be a part of hearing to give their side of the story. And so that is a concern for me. And, you know, I've worked a little bit in family law as a legislator. I am no expert, but one of the things that we hear on custody issues a lot is that you have to go to a judge if you want to move to another state and there's an order for custody. And I feel like this kind of takes away judicial discretion, because most of the time it's very difficult for one parent to even move to a different state with that child, because they know that that's going to limit the time that another parent is going to, the parent that's not moving with the child is going to have with that child. And so I have great concerns about this whole custody piece. And I feel like it gives one parent an advantage over the other in cases where there is some shared parenting going on. And the cases that have made national news are the ones that where there is a split in the family and one parent leaves, takes the kid to another state, and the other parent is left holding the bag. So I have concerns on many levels with this bill, but that is one of them. So, Madam Chair, if Representative Finke, I have another question, if that's okay.
Go ahead, Representative Scott.
Okay, thank you. If this bill is truly about protecting families and children from prosecution in other states, why the need for temporary emergency jurisdiction?
Representative Finke, and I will actually say if we're, well, Representative Finke, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Scott. And I do want to take a moment to respond to the concern that you were just raising. That sounds like a real problem to me. That sounds like the idea that there are custody cases where both parents can't have their opportunity to be heard sounds like a very serious problem in a custodial court system. I don't see how that affects why that's our responsibility or this bill's responsibility. That sounds like if people are doing this, it sounds like people are doing that, and I think that there's probably something to be addressed around the equity around custody cases. And I'm not familiar with that problem, but I hear it, and I think, okay, well, we should talk about that, but I don't think that has anything to do with gender-affirming care. But I do appreciate the question that you're raising. Emergency jurisdiction is necessary in this bill because what we are saying is that parents have a right to receive gender-affirming care if they live in South Dakota. And if South Dakota is not going to allow those parents to provide for the best care for their child, then Minnesota can do that. And if that's going to lead to custodial decisions, then we need to be able to have temporary emergency custody in the state of Minnesota for those parents to have their ability to provide for their children.
Representative Scott, and then we do have an interpreter and other bills today, so just to keep all members to be mindful, but Representative Scott.
Madam Chair. Representative Finke, well, this does relate. Your bill does relate because as far as these custody matters that I just described, because you're adding another factor that will make it more difficult. It will make it more difficult potentially for one parent to provide their say in the matter of custody because of the example of a parent having to travel here from Alaska that's a low-income person. So I think that this piles on to what's already happening and further ties one parent's hand behind their back if they don't agree with gender-affirming care. So I think that it is a real problem in this bill. Madam Chair, again, I want to make, I know we're wanting to move on to the next bill, but I will move that this bill go to Health Finance Representative Finke even said that the definition of gender-affirming care probably needs work. So, and there's going to be most likely a fiscal note if parents are bringing their children here. If these are low-income parents and they can't afford the gender-affirming care, the state of Minnesota will have to pay for it. And so I would like to make, I would move that this bill be re-referred to the Committee on Health Finance.
And I just want to, can you just not, just to clarify, were you saying that the definition of gender-affirming care needs to be worked on, Representative Finke?
No.
Thank you. Just want to make sure we have that on the record.
I'd like a roll call, Madam.
All right. Roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll on Representative Scott's motion to move this to health finance. Is that what you said? Okay.
Chair Becker-Finn.
No.
Vice Chair Frazier.
No.
Lead Scott.
Yes.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Feist.
No.
Representative Finke.
No.
Representative Frederick.
No.
Representative Prossel.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Mueller.
No.
Representative Niska.
Yes.
Representative Weens.
Yes.
All right. With five ayes and eight noes, the motion does not prevail. Back to the bill. Representative Carroll, real quick. I know you, Representative Carroll actually has experience in the civil law world. I think he might be our only fully civil law attorney here, Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. Not only that, but in family court with you as a law clerk, to a judicial officer.
Back in the day.
And I think you could attest to this too, and to respond to Representative Scott's concerns regarding a parent in Alaska not taking part in any proceeding. At least in the 4th Judicial District, Hennepin County, the judicial officers bend over backwards to accommodate appearances remotely or in other, you know, other than being present, so that parent in Alaska would have the opportunity, no doubt, to take part in any proceeding. Just wanted to point that out to you.
Yeah, that is helpful. Thank you, Representative Carroll. Representative Finke, any closing comments before we move forward? And again, with the motion now would be renewing Representative Finke's motion that House File 146 as amended be referred to the General Register. Closing comments, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Thank you to members, all of the members. I appreciate the discussion that we've had here. I appreciate that there is real concern and there is real fear and there is real debate about what we're talking about. But what I want us to leave this room thinking is recognizing, knowing that gender-affirming care is health care. And if gender-affirming care is health care, we're not changing any laws in the state of Minnesota. We're providing health care to people who need health care, and we currently provide this health care. And that's why it's in judiciary, that's why it belongs here, because we're not making changes to what it means to provide health care in the state of Minnesota. And as to, I'll just close really quickly by saying that the existence of trans people, the existence of trans children, the ability of us to live and thrive is not incumbent upon other people's understandings of how or why we exist. We don't need to justify our lives. We don't need to justify the ability to provide meaningful, well experienced existence in the world and to access healthcare to allow us to do that. That should not depend upon any individual's willingness to accept that we are here and that we deserve healthcare. So we're here anyways, and we want our healthcare, and we want to provide it to everyone in the country. So thank you for your consideration. Please vote yes.
All right. A roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Lead Scott.
No.
Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Finke.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Niska.
No.
Representative Weens.
No.
Eight ayes, five nays.
All right. With eight ayes and five nays, the motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to the General Register as amended. Thank you, Representative Finke, and thank you for coming back, Dr. Gepford. Going to switch things around with the order today. We're going to go to I actually want to make sure we've got time for Representative Daniels' bill, since I know we have interpreters, and I know from experience on some of my bills, sometimes that takes a little bit longer. So we will go to Representative Daniels' bill, House File 909. Representative Daniels, if you want to come on up. And our interpreters, our whole team, could make their way up. I will move that House File 909 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All right, Representative Daniels, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. I appreciate the opportunity to bring House File 909 before us today. This bill has been around for about 4 years. I believe Representative Scott spoke on it either last year or the year before in a different committee, and it was well received, and I appreciate the comments. We have a number of testifiers here to help us explain how important it is to maybe hopefully get this passed and get over the finish line this year. Got to mention one of our testifiers couldn't make it. It was Jan McCready Johnson and Neil Johnson, and they have been working on this as long as I've been working on it, and they just couldn't make it today, but I want to mention their names because they put a lot of time and effort into it. I have Alicia Lane Outlaw with me today. She's going to be testifying on behalf of the Commission on Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing, and two other testifiers. And I just give you a little background. About 8 years ago, I was able and fortunate enough to pass a bill that would allow closed captioning on clinics and hospitals' public waiting rooms. And that went through rather smoothly. And we thought we'd try to get this one through. Because what it's going to do, what this bill does, is just allow closed caption be on all the time in public areas, so bars, restaurants, those type of things. And I'm from Faribault, and that's where the deaf school is. So it's my community, basically. My oldest son graduated from the deaf school in 1999, and that school, you know, just was excellent for him. He went from very low proficiency in everything in the school, from grades to athletics. He spent 4 years at the deaf school, and he's just so successful right now. I'm just so proud of him. But part of that is when they're in public places, they have no idea what's going on. And one of my testifiers, Sonny Wazlowski, was actually my son's classmate, and he brought to my attention if I think it was the tornadoes going through possibly in 2018, and they had no idea. There was a lot of motion on the TV, a lot of people talking about what's going on, and the deaf community doesn't know what's going on without closed captioning. So to me, it's an extremely important bill. I think it's time to put it into statute, and at that point, I don't want to waste any more time because I know we're short. I want to turn over to my testifier.
All right. Thank you, Representative Daniels. And I want to thank you, too, Representative Daniels and I have both been working on bills that will benefit our community of folks who are deaf in Minnesota, and it really has been a pleasure to work with you. We've both kind of worked on different sides of different issues for the deaf community, and I really appreciate your work in this area as well. So we'll move on to testifiers. First up, we have Alicia Lane Outlaw. And I also want to thank our interpreters. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony. If the interpreter wants to move to the inside of the
the circle here, and then you can face that way so you can still see our testifier and then speak into that one of those mics. Thank you. We've done it that way in the past. I just know from my bills.
Testing, testing. All right, I want to make sure that everyone can hear and everyone has access to what I'm saying. Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and committee members. My name is Alicia Lane. I am the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Commission of the Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing. I am here today to express the Commission's support for House File 909. You'll find in your packets my or our letter of support, as well as an explanation with that goes into a little bit more detail about why this bill is necessary. So I don't want to be repetitive. I know that we're already a little bit behind on time, but I just want to share a real short story of a personal experience that I have. So I've been deaf since I was a baby, and there are many other deaf folks that have a similar experience to me. And we have experienced going to a place with a TV on without captions on. We asked them to turn the captions on. And what happened to me was I went to a restaurant that was right next to the School for the Deaf. And that School for the Deaf has many deaf staff who go to that restaurant after work. And I looked at the TVs and I had asked if they could turn the captions on. And, you know, of course they say, hold on, I don't know, let me see. And 30 to 45 minutes later, I waited and asked again, and they said, I don't know, we don't know how to do it, I can't do it. So then the next time I came, a few months later, again, no captions were on the TV, and I know that I'm not the only one that has been asking for this. And you'll see in my letter of support that the commission has done all kinds of things trying to encourage people to turn the captions on in public places, and it hasn't happened. And that's why we need this to become put into statute. So I appreciate your time and your support of House File 909. And thank you, Rep. Daniels.
Thank you. Next on the list, I have Keenan Gao. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Keenan Gao. I'm a civic engagement and outreach specialist with the Minnesota Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing. I'm also a member of the Hearing Loss Association of America. I am here before you today because for me, HF 909 is a safety issue for me and over 1 million Minnesotans. After I graduated from University of Minnesota in 2017, I did a multi-day camping trip with a group of people in a remote outdoors area in northern Minnesota. When we arrived and checked in for the trip, the expedition tour guides had us watch safety videos on their television. This video covered crucial topics: fire safety, what to do in the event of a wildfire, and how to appropriately dispose of and bury your waste. My cohort was able to watch the entire safety videos, but for me, it did not have captions. I would see people doing different things, walking around, showing and gesturing, but I had no idea what was going on. I never camped before in my life, and I was unable to access the information. I had to ask my cohort to summarize, and I have no way of knowing if they left anything out. I wish that I could say this had an impact on me. It didn't. Growing up, I have experienced the lack of accessibility with closed captioning on safety videos in public places so many times. To give a few examples, amusement park rides, indoor trampoline parks, even on airlines before they were federally mandated to have captioned safety videos. Some Minnesotan businesses are aware and do provide closed captioning on their televisions, but others do not. The reality is this has become so consistent that it became so inconsistent that it became normalized for me to be used to this. It is only until I got older that I understood an important distinction. My indifference to my own safety when I was younger wasn't a result of my own judgment. It is the result of how we collectively allow public spaces to have the choice to provide captions, to have a choice of providing a lower value on my safety compared to your safety. So I am here before you today, Chair Becca Finn and other members of the committee, because I've decided I'm not okay with being complacent about my safety or access to information. So I urge committee members to support HF 909 to require closed captions on televisions in public spaces. I urge you to value my access and my safety at the same level of yours. Thank you so much and have a good day.
Thank you for your testimony. Next and our last testifier on this bill is Sunny Wasilowski. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Sunny Wasilowski, and I'm from Faribault. Chair, Representative Becker Finn, and committee members, thank you for having testimonies on House File 909. I'm here to share my passion and my goal to end language deprivation and provide children with access and the right to language and those with hearing loss. Language deprivation is exceedingly rare for hearing people, but for people with hearing loss and those that experience the intersectionality of hearing loss, unfortunately, is prevalent. In numbers research, language deprivation is a syndrome that happens, and it puts us at risk for mental health delays, difficulties, less quality of life, higher level of trauma, and literacy limitations. Did you say House File 909? Yes, House File 909. This is for people with hearing loss that later in life often have the risk of dementia, depression due to social isolation. I'm asking the committee to allow to pass this closed caption bill, House File 909, in order to give access and prevent for safer environments so that we can have access to language, whether you're hearing or whether you're reading it through captioning. And I'm asking for that, for language access, so that we have better quality of life for many. I hope that when I go back home and share with family and friends and the community at large, that we will see captioning ready in open spaces. And I already envision being able to be realized that we no more have to be responsible to ask for closed caption to be put on where there is no caption. Thank you. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any member discussion. I'll say it. We still want to get to the towing bill, especially if it looks like we might not have a hearing on Thursday. So any discussion to this bill? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm glad we're finally here. And I know we did hear this. Didn't we hear this via Zoom during
COVID?
Yeah,
we did.
So thank you for all the testifiers being here today and being just so just consistent with your support and taking time off from your lives to come down here today. And this is a good bill. It needs to be done. Let's get it over the finish line.
Yeah, we're hoping we could even move this maybe as a standalone if we can kick the Senate into gear as well. So I will renew my motion that House File 909 be recommended. Oh, I guess, Representative Daniel, sorry, I didn't give you closing comments.
That's all right.
You did such a good job at the beginning.
Well, I was just thinking, I forgot to mention that it's already federal law that if a person requests closed caption on a TV in a public place, that's how the law is. It's supposed to be turned on. So we're just trying to enforce this. You might just leave it on, make it simpler for the restaurants and the bars and all the public facilities. We have really good support. I've got three authors on the House side, including Representative Newton, and on the Senate side, I've got five authors there, Abler, and then the four from the other side of the aisle. So we have good bipartisan support. I always like to have that in my bills, have both sides agree that this is a good thing to do and move it ahead. And I appreciate your time for hearing the House File 909. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. And with that, I will turn it over to you.
All right. With that, we'll renew my motion that House File 909 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Daniels, and thank you to our testifiers. I will sign on. I've signed on so many times in the past. We've been trying to do this for so long, I forgot I wasn't signed on yet this year. So, Representative Moeller, we fit you in. And I can't go late because we got to be over on the floor at 10:10. So, Representative Moeller, would you like to move your bill? I believe this is also going to the General Register.
That is my motion, Madam Chair. Thank
you. All right. Please tell us about House File 975.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll be brief. House File, I'll go ahead. House File 975 is also one of those bills we've heard in the past. It's seeking to create a remedy to fix a problem that we thought the legislature had solved in 2008, and that is when poor people have their cars towed. For many poor people, that means all of their belongings are in their cars. And so in 2008, the legislature created the right to be able to get access to these things from their cars if they showed the proper paperwork. They're being denied that access. And so this creates a remedy in order to ensure that people can get things like medication and medical equipment out of their cars. That is what this bill does. And I do have one testifier. And before she goes, I'll just note that this is the compromise bill. And you've got a letter in your packets from the Towing Association. Thank you.
Great. I've got Hannah Anderson. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Hannah Anderson. I'm an attorney at Fagree Drinker, and I'm here today to voice my strong support for House File 975. Representative Moeller gave you a great introduction to what this bill is all about here. Really, this became an issue that we were aware of when over the last couple of years, myself and my firm were retained by a couple of pro bono clients who were homeless, living out of their vehicles at the time. Their vehicles were towed, in one case for a medical emergency behind the wheel, in another case for just a general car accident. And when they went to exercise their right under current Minnesota law to retrieve these belongings without paying the towing charges, they were denied access and were told that they needed to provide additional proof that is not required under the statute. Unfortunately, we're aware that it's more common than just those two isolated cases. In one of the cases, the client had provided documentation that he was homeless from a nonprofit agency. He also provided documentation from a legal aid office indicating that he was receiving legal aid services. So, as I'm sure you all can imagine, when you're homeless and living out of your vehicle, everything you own is in there, various forms of identification, medication, medical equipment, items of sentimental value. And in that particular case I just mentioned, by the time we got involved, the car had already been scrapped with all of the client's belongings in the vehicle. So what House File 975 is really designed to do is make sure that that type of situation doesn't happen to Minnesotans in the future. We want to make sure that we do that so that if this unencumbered right to retrieve your belongings is violated down the road, there's some form of recourse or some form of compensation available. So I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Otherwise, thank you all very much for your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. There's hardly anyone else in the room, but is there anyone else from the public wishing to testify on this bill? No. All right. Member discussion, Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckovin, Representative Moeller. On line 3.6, it deals with deals with a nonprofit agency for some type of benefit or showing some type of benefit, is my understanding. A photo ID or to prove that they're receiving government benefit. Do we have any nonprofit agencies that are giving government benefits out that would providing services
Representative Mueller.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Ron Elwood is here, and he can answer that question.
Yeah, and I'll say, too, that in my reading of it, it also would be a nonprofit agency who might be attesting to the fact that the person is homeless, because it's an or and not an and. But Mr. Elwood, please introduce yourself and answer the question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Madam Chair, Representative Johnson. Well, first of all, the line you're referring to is a notice that's posted. That's number one. And it's just telling people what their rights are. And to answer your question specifically, no, it's not that the government, it's not that the nonprofit is giving out the benefit. It's that the nonprofit would be working with the client to obtain the benefit from the agency and can attest to the fact that they did it.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin, thanks for the explanation. I'm seeing nonprofits too many times all across. Normally we don't see it in judiciary, but in other committees of mine, I'm seeing nonprofits come up dramatically. We had the OLA report about nonprofits. So when I see that, I get concerned. Representative Mueller, I want to thank you for this bill. I have no problems getting the medications and stuff like that to those who've had their vehicles towed. Most towing companies, they do not want the car. But the biggest issue is that they've found, and in a lot of the tow operators I've talked to and worked with over the years, is the people that want their property, they don't want their car because they haven't transferred the title, they cannot prove insurance. And so it's not their car. How do we tell if the property, their concern is how do you tell if the property in the car not registered to them is their property? And that's the issue that some of the tow operators have been trying to deal with, to make sure that the proper owners of the property in the vehicle is getting their property back.
Representative Mueller, any quick comment to that?
I've not heard that concern, and this was a heavily negotiated bill with the towing association. So of all the concerns I've ever heard from the towing companies, that is not one I've heard. I think Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Elwood, real quick.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I'd just like to point out that on line 121.21, it requires proof of identity of the registered owner. And I know you want to leave. I just do want to thank you, Chair Beckerfin, and Lead Scott for co-authoring this bill as well. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Scott.
Real quickly, Madam Chair. Representative Mueller, in the letter from the association, it says that they had hoped that they would get the public impound lots included in this, and for some reason, that didn't happen. It doesn't really elaborate as to why. Just curious on that count.
Representative Mueller.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. It's my understanding that this isn't a problem that's the public impound lots are, that people are having with the public impound lots. It's they're having it with other tow companies.
All right. Follow up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if something changes and they don't become cooperative, will you be back to make this bill applicable to them as well?
Representative Mueller.
Well, it's my understanding they're following the law as written in 2008, so they've had plenty of time to, you know, they're complying, so I don't see any reason to include them at this point since it's been around for a while and they're complying.
Madam Chair.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Mueller.
Appreciate your support. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Representative Mueller renews her motion that House Bill 975 be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Curran, I know you have a testifier, so I at least want to get the testifier on the record. So if you want to come down. I know you traveled all the way from Vadnais Heights. Very familiar with how far away that is. So Representative Curran, would you like to move House File 14 be brought before the committee? And I will say we thought we were going to have the updated fiscal note, and we don't. So we're actually going to be laying this over, and we won't move it until we have the updated fiscal note. So really just want to get this before the committee and have 2 minutes for testimony. But Representative Curran, if you want to give us a little intro on what this bill does, some of us are already familiar.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Chair. And this is a pretty simple bill. It just it's a technical change to the amount that goes to a municipality within Ramsey County from fines and fees. And it changes it from a lower amount to be consistent with other municipalities within Ramsey County.
All right. Mr. Watson, if you want to introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. Kevin Watson, I'm the city administrator in Vadnais Heights. We're just up the road, 10 minutes, so didn't have to come far, but I appreciate the opportunity to come and represent my colleagues and other communities. We're looking for your support to kind of fix an inequity that's in law for some reason. So as mentioned, Vadnais Heights and other suburban communities in Ramsey County receive 50% of fines and forfeitures that are issued by the courts. St. Paul gets two-thirds of that. The rest of the state gets two-thirds. I think Hennepin County gets a little quirky change in there.
Funny too. How that is.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that but just looking to change that. This wouldn't change our behavior at all. We'd stay consistent with how we're currently conducting our business. Just looking for a little help on the equity side of things. So.
All right. Any quick comments from the committee before I lay this over? But thank you, Mr. Watson, for being here. I guess if anyone has questions for Mr. Watson while he's here. All right. With that, thank you very much for coming down. Sorry we had to squeeze you in. We'll discuss this a little further when we actually have the numbers again. We thought we'd have the fiscal note, but didn't get it in time. So with that, I will lay over House File 1414. Thank you, members. We did it. With that, we are adjourned.